This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Paul Findley, former United States Congressman from Illinois, 11 terms on Capitol Hill. He is a opponent of military action in Syria, and we'll reflect on President Obama's address to the nation and the world last night. Also, Melinda DeLotte, correspondent for the Associated Press here in Louisiana, on the controversy swirling about the LSU Board of Supervisors, with Judge Janice Clark of Baton Rouge threatening to throw the board members in jail if they don't comply with her demand to cough up the names of those who were candidates to become LSU system president when King Alexander was hired. And we'll hear from businessman Cam Morton, who's back in Baton Rouge with some major initiatives. All this, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your local number. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org online. Last night, President Obama, facing an almost certain defeat in obtaining congressional support for a military strike against Syria, told the nation that he would give serious consideration to a proposal by Russia that international monitors take over and destroy Syria's arsenal of chemical weapons. The address to the nation and the world from the president came on the heels of international attention about Syria and chemical weapons, and the president calling for military intervention by the United States. With us to discuss the latest developments, Paul Findley, former congressman from Illinois, who served 22 years on Capitol Hill. Good morning to you, Congressman
Findley. Good morning.
What's your assessment of where we are right now as far as the president and his address last night?
The Russian initiative, which seems to bring the possibility of a removal of all of the chemical weapons from Syria, is a surprise development that I think is promising. It's not a certainty to solve the problem, but it is well worth looking into.
Now,
the prospect of the president ordering any limited acts of war against Syria is still muddled, I think, in the minds of some senior members of the Congress and perhaps also in the mind of the president. He has no legal way that he can assault Syria in the absence of approval by the Congress. That is a very clear fact that he doesn't seem to face directly, but he should realize that a careful reading of the War Powers Resolution does not give him a 60-day window for initiative on his own. Some people read, just scanning the War Powers Resolution, have come to the conclusion that the 60-day window is actually an opening for any president to make war at will. It is not at all. It deals only with the acts of the president acting in an emergency.
Paul Findley is the guest, the former congressman from Illinois, who says the president could not have legally gone to war without approval from Congress, and the president, of course, has decided to go that route if the United States intervenes in Syria. But how is this different, Congressman, than Ronald Reagan going to war in Grenada without congressional approval? Did Reagan break the law?
Ronald Reagan, are you speaking of his action on Grenada?
I am.
He did not seek approval, but he acted as if it were an emergency, and probably it was so viewed by the students in the medical school on Grenada. So he therefore was acting within the bounds set forth clearly by the Congress and by the War Powers Act.
Well, if Grenada was an emergency, wouldn't Syria be in an emergency where people are being gassed and killed by the leader of the country?
Well, if he had responded to that threat, he could have been in compliance with the War Powers Resolution and the Constitution. But he did not. He told Congress they could complete their vacation, and there was no big hurry about acting on a resolution approving war against, or small acts of war against Syria.
Now, Congressman,
well, he thereby denied himself the access to the 60-day window that's certified in the War Powers Resolution. That is available only to presidents who act immediately to meet a crisis and do so without congressional approval, because the situation is so dire and threatening that waiting for Congress to act would be a serious setback for the U.S. national interest.
You're a Republican, Congressman. You've been out of office for a while, but it seems as though the usual positions of the respective national parties, the positions have changed. You've got the Democrats, people like Nancy Pelosi now calling for military intervention, and you've got hawks on the Republican side, usual hawks, calling for the United States not to get involved. How do you square this? Is it all about politics?
Well, I'm a Lincoln Republican, or you could say I'm an Eisenhower Republican, because I certainly approve thoroughly with the way they handled War Powers. But I do not believe that the president should be able to, on his own, make acts of war against any country.
Charles in North Baton Rouge. Charles, you're on the air with former Congressman Paul Findlay of Illinois.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Congressman. Congressman, you said in the past that September 11th was the result of the U.S. Basically blanket support for Israel in the Middle East. If the president feels that securing and controlling chemical weapons is not only a threat for the people of the Middle East, but potentially for America, how then can his actions not be viewed as emergency?
All right. Charles says it can be constructed as an emergency. As far as the potential action against Syria?
Well, it was not such an emergency, because he was perfectly willing to wait for the Congress to finish its vacation and then take up the question. Had it been an emergency, he would have acted instantly with some sort of steps against Syria, but he did not do so. He deliberately delayed any action from the U.S. toward Syria, and that altered the scene completely as far as the war powers of the president are concerned.
You took office the same month, January 1961, as a congressman that President Kennedy was inaugurated as Commander-in-Chief. I'm sure you were there when the president gave his inaugural address, which was certainly a strong address about the U.S. being the peacekeeper in the world and going to war when necessary. Have times changed dramatically in 52 years?
Well, he made a beautiful statement. I applauded vigorously. But when you get down to the nitty-gritty of our war powers, you're talking about death and destruction, and steps like that need to be reserved for something that's a deliberate threat to the well-being of the United States. We should not act as if we're the policemen of the world, although we've been acting that way in recent years. We ought to recognize that we have the major responsibility of protecting our territory, our citizens, our warships, and our commerce. But that is the realm that the president has in choosing to use war powers. Only when those factors are at risk can he immediately take action without the advance approval of Congress.
Congressman Paul Findlay, thank you so much for joining us. A gallant man, now 92 years young, took office in 1961, and let's talk again soon, sir. Thank you, Paul Findlay. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and thank you for your support over the last several days, and we appreciate your contributions. And if you've not made your contribution in the fall drive, we ask you to do so right now. Please keep WRKF close to you in a very tangible way by showing your support. 297-5633 is the number to talk on the air with our next guest, Melinda DeLotte, correspondent for the Associated Press of Louisiana. She covers much that happens in Baton Rouge and beyond. And right now in our city, in addition to the Les Miles controversy, is a major controversy regarding the 16-member LSU Board of Supervisors and Judge Janice Clark, who has held the board in contempt for not revealing the names of the candidates other than King Alexander for the presidency of Louisiana State University. 119 days, $500 a day fine from Judge Clark. The board has been held in contempt, and so far no names. And Melinda, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim.
And there was a development, big development yesterday. What happened?
Well, there were several developments yesterday. It was sort of a bizarre day in court. In the morning, Judge Clark issued an order to the sheriff's office to go out and try to physically seize whatever records the LSU Board of Supervisors had at the system building. And when the deputies went out to the system office, LSU officials told them, "We don't have any information here. All of that information is housed in Dallas, Texas, at the consulting firm of the man we hired to do the search." So the deputies went back empty-handed to Judge Clark, and one of the deputies testified in court. And by the end of the day, the judge seemed to have come to some sort of compromise, perhaps, with the attorneys for both sides. They're working on a deal where both sides could agree to a stipulation where LSU would provide the information to the judge, but the judge would be able to keep it and view it, but it wouldn't be released to the public while the LSU Board of Supervisors continues to go through its cycle of appealing the judge's order. So they're supposed to go back into court on Monday at 1 o'clock and report to the judge on whether the attorneys for both sides could actually reach some terms.
877-217-5757, Inkster Show at WRKF.org, if you would like to join the conversation with Melinda DeLotte of the Associated Press of Louisiana. This has been going on for 4 months now, and Judge Clark is not happy about the fact that the board has not coughed up the names. And yesterday, when sheriff's deputies were sent to the LSU campus, Melinda, LSU says it doesn't have the names.
Which is something they've maintained the entire time. They've claimed that the search was conducted by William Funk and Associates, which is a search firm out of Dallas, Texas. And Mr. Funk set up some sort of web portal where members of the Board of Supervisors could go in and look at the various candidates who were being proposed and considered, and their information, whether it be resumes or whatever kind of information there was in background on them. And so they've said that they've never had those documents on their campus because it was in a web portal that has now been disconnected. And so all the information, they say, is in Dallas instead of on site. And that's what they've maintained the entire time this case has been going on.
Well, it would seem that the 16 members of the LSU board, at least 15 of them, independent of the student member, probably have the names. They must have printed them out when they were on a web portal. So I suppose the sheriff deputies could go to the offices of Rolf McAllister or Stanley Jacobs or John George or Ann Duplessis. They could go to any one of these board members and try to get the names as well, the sheriff's deputies in whatever jurisdiction there is. It seemed that movement on LSU's part came when these board members were threatened with jail time. That suddenly changed the inertia on this.
Well, it did in a way. I mean, it was kind of strange because when the seizure order got issued in the morning yesterday, it didn't seem as though LSU had changed its position at all. But sometime by the end of the afternoon, when Judge Clark had brought the attorneys into her chambers, things seemed to get a little less frosty, and it seemed as though perhaps they could reach some sort of compromise agreement. But for a while, Judge Clark was very directly and obviously frustrated and angry with the attorney for the LSU Board of Supervisors, Jimmy Faircloth. And for a while, I think some people in the courtroom, myself included, were wondering if she was going to haul off Mr. Faircloth in handcuffs. But they seem to have come to some sort of terms by the end of it.
Well, our listener points out, Jackie does, that Nicholls State yesterday announced its president of the university. By the way, the new president is a colonel, and so is his wife, and it's the Nicholls State Colonels. But the Nicholls process, according to Jackie, and she is correct, was totally transparent. We knew who the candidates were. We knew who the finalists were. We knew who was interviewed, and we knew who was hired. What's the big deal about LSU keeping this so secretive?
Well, LSU's Board of Supervisors has kind of always drawn a distinction about its own system and the flagship university in particular, suggesting that the level of candidates they wanted to vet for the position would be candidates who were sitting university presidents and sitting chancellors at other big-name universities around the country, and that those people wouldn't want to let their own bosses know that they might be considering applying for a different job, and they wouldn't want to be considered if their name was publicly released. And so LSU has always suggested that the caliber of candidate that they are looking for because of their position at the flagship university, that is somehow different than the way perhaps smaller universities go about their searches.
Now, when Mark Emmert was hired as chancellor at LSU, it was a public process. He was listed as a finalist. We knew who he was competing against, and he arguably is the best chancellor LSU has had in a while. I still don't get it as far as LSU saying that secrecy is a necessity to finding a good person. If that's the case, then Emmert was not as good as the choice would have been had they had a secret process in 1999.
Well, but they have used secret processes before. I mean, they may not have done so for Emmert, but they did for other university presidents and chancellors over the years. So it's not unprecedented for them to go this route. I will also note that the members of the board now, I suspect very few, if any of them, were around on the board when the board selected Mark Emmert.
They were not. They were not, although Rolf McAllister was a board member prior to Emmert being selected, and he came back when Bobby Jindal was elected governor and appointed his good friend, the publisher of the Business Report, to the board again. Now, let's say Scott Angell, public service commissioner, who's on the LSU Board of Supervisors, decides that he's had enough, he wants to leak the names. He could do this very privately to some reporter, you, me, or somebody else, and this whole thing would be over with. Does the Board of Supervisors have some complicity in this controversy that has now swirled for 119 days?
Well, I mean, absolutely. The board members have also refused to release that information or provide any details about the candidates who were considered before King Alexander was hired. That has been the policy of the board, and so therefore it would suggest that all of the board members are complicit in complying with that policy. So obviously they have done so. One of the things that the LSU board attorney, Jimmy Faircloth, argues is that if they turn over the names now, they will have essentially forfeited their right to appeal, and that they want the ability to argue their case to an appeals court and possibly to the Supreme Court because they feel that they are on solid legal footing in their position of keeping the names private.
But if they turn them over without the board stamp of approval, and as a reporter generally does not reveal his or her sources, we wouldn't know where the names came from, or we wouldn't tell. At least I can't imagine a reporter doing so. So no one would even know that an LSU board member released the names. But it would seem that this would make this story less of a public situation. It's certainly become very public now.
Oh, I can't imagine it's less than a headache or more than that for the board at this point, because they are getting nothing but bad publicity about this lawsuit continuing and their refusal to comply with this order.
And it's put attention on the board, perhaps attention the board does not want. Here we have a state with one-third African-American citizens, and when I look at the 16-member LSU board, we've got one black and one woman, 15 white males and one black female. Is that reflective of the state of Louisiana? It's a rhetorical question, but I think it's worthy of consideration. What is going on with this kind of representation on the board of the flagship University of Louisiana, Melinda?
Well, that's obviously been a point of criticism for Governor Bobby Jindal during his two terms in office, that he has not necessarily appointed a lot of minority and or female members to some of the university system boards and the Black Caucus members and some other folks over the years have raised complaints about his appointments and the lack of diversity in some of his appointments.
Well, what do you think will happen? What happens Monday?
With Judge Clark, I honestly have no idea. This case has taken some interesting and bizarre twists throughout the time that it's been ongoing. I will say that the lawyers for both the two newspapers and for the LSU board seemed very sincere in trying to come to some sort of resolution, because quite frankly, the LSU board can't file its full and formal appeal with the First Circuit until Judge Clark signs off on a final judgment, which she has been unwilling to do while this saga has been ongoing. So the lawyers did seem as though they were very interested in coming to some sort of resolution and said they would be working through the weekend to try and come up with some sort of deal that they could present to the judge on Monday.
Another listener, Carly, notes that LSU was victorious in this same dispute in the court of Judge Tim Kelly. How does that affect, if at all, the dispute before Judge Clark?
Well, right now it doesn't affect anything to do with Judge Clark. She's very aware of the other ruling in across the hall from her courtroom, and that hasn't swayed her in any sense. And the question becomes whether that will do something at the appellate court level, whether judges on the appeals court will look at the lower court rulings and contrast what has happened in Judge Kelly's court in some fashion, or at least take that into consideration. But Judge Clark is very well aware of what happened across the hall, and that has done nothing to persuade her that she needs to take a different course.
Melinda, you're a graduate of LSU, right?
I am.
And the University of Maryland?
Yes.
Correct. All right, here's a question from Kristen asking, what are the requirements, or what are the, I'm trying to read her email, what are the requirements to be an LSU board member?
Well, I mean, the board members are appointed by the governor. I'm not sure if there are any specific educational requirements or any background requirements that are laid out in any kind of statute or executive order or rules for the board that the governor has to follow. I mean, they're usually prominent members of the business or educational community. A lot of them are former politicians. But I'm not necessarily sure that there are any set lists of qualifications that those board members have to meet in order to be appointed.
I think the biggest requirement is to be a supporter of the governor.
Some people would suggest that campaign contributions to the appointing governor always tend to help. And indeed, the appointees to the board currently, most if not all of the governor's appointees have donated money to his campaign.
And my friend Rolf, who does a fine job as a publisher of the Business Report and 225 and InRegister, he is the head of the governor's nonprofit fundraising arm, correct?
Correct, and he is definitely a supporter of the governor. He makes no apologies about that and doesn't try to hide it. It's very well known that Rolf is a fan and a friend of Governor Jindal.
But as a journalist, it would seem that of the 16 members, he would be the one who would be most likely to leak the names. Is his responsibility greater to the LSU hierarchy and the governor, or is it to the readers of his publications?
I suspect that's a question you probably have to pose to Rolf to ask how he sees his positions and how he reconciles how he acts as a board member on the one hand and how he acts as the publisher of several well-known publications in the community on the other hand.
Thank you, Melinda DeLotte of the Associated Press. Fine reporter. We'll talk soon. Thank you, Melinda.
Thanks, Jim.
Back after this timeout. This is Jim Engster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and we're joined by Cam Morton, veteran Baton Rouge businessperson and a native of Birmingham, Alabama. Music that J.C. Kane is playing is appropriate on this day, maybe the only day it's appropriate. 100th birthday of the legendary Paul William Bear Bryant, born on this date, September 11, 1913, in Fordyce, Arkansas. 6 national titles for the Bear at Alabama, and a 21-5-1 record against Louisiana State University at Alabama, Kentucky, and Texas A&M. And good morning to you, Cam Morton.
Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine. I'm sure you remember the Bear as a young man in Birmingham.
Oh, absolutely. Even though my parents went to Auburn, the rest of the family went to Alabama, and he was God in them their parts.
He was. It's amazing that he was immune to the politics of the time, or so it seemed. George Wallace was governor and stirring the pot, and Bear Bryant was like this epic figure who just was invisible when it came to controversies of that kind. He got in some others, but he managed to keep his integrity.
He did. He was the guy who really, I think, changed the landscape and the way football was played, playing with a platoon system, taking as many as 100 people on the road with him. Very interesting guy. Certainly my whole family was a huge fan, at least as long as they weren't playing Auburn.
Did you ever meet him?
I did. I happened to be living in East Carolina, in Greenville, North Carolina, when Pat Dye was at East Carolina University, and the Bear came to speak as a favor to Pat Dye, and I got his autograph, got to speak to him, actually took pictures with him being interviewed by a friend of mine who was in the radio business.
Did you keep that autograph?
I have the autograph book, and I still have the pictures.
Wow. That's a keeper, Bear Bryant. He was a worthy legend, and LSU fans both reviled him and revered him. And his last game against LSU, he lost 20-10, November 6, 1982, against Jerry Stovall and LSU at Birmingham. But prior to that, he had won 11 in a row against LSU. So he was a thorn in the Tigers' side, probably got his protege Charlie McClendon fired, who was 2-14 against Paul Bear Bryant. When did you end up in Baton Rouge, Cam?
We moved here in 2002, a little over 10 years ago now.
And you've been involved in some of the big projects in this city
over
the last
decade.
Yeah,
it's been my pleasure and good fortune to be involved in some projects like Boncaray and the Hilton downtown, and helping a lot of other people bring downtown Baton Rouge closer to its former glory, and I think it's still making great progress.
Let's start with Boncaré. It is a shopping center that we remember as the old Bon Marché, and it was a nice place in its time and located right on the fringe of Mall City. Some would say that was an area where it was prudent to just jump ship, get out of Dodge, but there's a beautiful facility there now.
It has been through a lot of changes over the years. I guess one of the Mall City became kind of Mall City because those apartment complexes were really not suited for families, and they were small. So a lot of crime moved into the area. The mall, as having been in the regional mall business, the mall kind of changed. The designs of malls changed and moved on down the road to a brand new one, and ultimately that changed, as we all know, moved out to the Mall of Louisiana. But it kind of left an old, nice structure for other uses, but generally they're hard to do. It had gotten started by a guy who had a huge vision and fell into some trouble, I think, because he had issues. And we were fortunate enough to get the support of the Baton Rouge community and our local congressman, Baker, to get it jump started again. Louisiana Tech Park, Eddie Ashworth, to turn it into a big kind of high-tech office building kind of structure today. And I think it's a great-looking building, partly because of what the first guy did.
Well, 22 years ago, or actually it was a 22-year hiatus, 7 years ago, the Hilton downtown reopened after being closed from 84 to 2006. It was a big eyesore, a historic building, one that I think the populace wanted to keep around, but took a lot of effort to do that.
Well, talking about legends, I guess, you know, Huey Long actually held the legislature there for a while when mm-hmm. he was both senator and governor, and there was a lot of history to the place that made it special to Baton Rougeans and to Louisianans in general. And there was a lot of talk about just tearing it down and starting over, which probably from a cost point of view might have been the best way to handle it. But you lose history that way. And today it sits on the river with terrific river views. And really people are very proud of having that structure being saved and saved part of history. And I'm mm-hmm. proud to have been a small part of it.
Well, Huey Long was killed 78 years ago yesterday at the state capitol. Actually, he was shot on the 8th at the capitol, died at Our Lady, the old Our Lady of the Lake Hospital a couple of days later. But how did the Hilton look in 1935?
Well, it was more the Heidelberg portion, which is the taller, more historic-looking building. His office on the fourth floor now is called the Huey Long Suite, and he would hold court there. But it was kind of a middle-of-the-road hotel, never meant to be kind of the first-class hotel it is today. Cost only $1 million back then to build. Hard to imagine, really, but it was about half the size of what the Hilton is today. It was a little over 100 rooms, mm-hmm. Smaller rooms, not much of a lobby. But what the lobby in that part of the building is restored, and you can see a lot of the woodwork that's in that.
So what are you doing right now?
I've just opened a new office for VR Business Sales, which is an international company which helps people buy and sell businesses. I thought it was a really good use of the skills I developed on Wall Street and buying and selling businesses and starting my own businesses to help other people buy and sell businesses.
Well, you went away for a little while and came back.
I guess I went away. I was around. I've been doing a lot of things for the Boy Scouts and mm-hmm. The Lieutenant Governor's Volunteer Louisiana Commission. But I really wanted to get back into something business-related, and this really feels good for me. VR's whole mission, a company that's 30 years old, over 30 years old, VR is a company which really believes in taking care of the customer and being there and helping them through what is a difficult period of time for many people selling a business. It's like giving away their child in many instances.
Well, we wish you well. Here's a question from Lamar. It's a pretty good one. He says, why does the Hilton downtown get tax incentives and the Marriott, which just went bankrupt, why does it not get the same kind of incentives?
I think generally speaking, the idea of TIF, or tax increment financing, is a tool used by governments to bring back structures that are significant to the community and help create a better community. Had without the tax incentives of the Hilton, what would naturally have occurred is it would have been knocked down and something probably less expensive and less grand would have been built there, which I think wouldn't have been as good for downtown. The Marriott, generally speaking, real estate goes bankrupt because it's either in a bad location or it's a bad time or somebody paid too much for it, or all three. they say about real estate, location, 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 but really it's timing, timing, timing.
Well, Cam, we wish you well, and we look forward to staying in touch.
Great. Thanks,
Take
Jim.
Care.
Good to see you.
Cam Morton. And thank you for your support this week. Please keep the phones ringing as we head down the turn and close it out for the fall drive of 2013 on WRKF.